This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Is a certified autism specialist, an emergency physician at MedStar Union Memorial Hospital, an assistant professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine, and the Emergency Medicine Residency Program. And she's going to help teach us how we can provide care in the emergency department that is that doesn't re-traumatize people, that that gains their cooperation and allows us to provide the care that we need to without increasing medical trauma and anxiety. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. I'm happy to be here. I'm Dr. Whitney Deal, and I am speaking in place of one of my colleagues who's presented at this conference for several years, but unfortunately, because of her position with HHS, was not permitted to do so this year. Excited to speak on the topic of autism and intellectual disability within the emergency department, and how we can specifically de-escalate the agitated patient using the least restrictive approach. I have nothing to disclose, and I'm going to start with the case of a six-year-old nonverbal autistic male who's been to the emergency department three times. His first visit was when he ingested a button battery, which you can see on this x-ray is in his stomach. And he chewed through a remote control in his home. His parents didn't realize till about 4 hours later when they found the chewed up remote control, but couldn't find the button battery. Thankfully, he made it okay through this. His second visit to the ER was for unusual activity that was disrupting his sleep in the night. Four and five times a night, he was waking up. Parents would find him rigid, somewhat sleepy appearing. And he ended up getting admitted to the hospital for a 24-hour EEG, which ultimately did not show any epileptic activity. His third visit to an emergency room occurred when he became inconsolable one day. He was screaming, crying, just absolutely out of his mind, and parents could not console him. It was very frightening, and they didn't know what was wrong. They thought maybe he must have ruptured his appendix. It turned out after a full workup in the emergency department that he was suffering from constipation. Now, this young man is actually my son, so please meet Milo. I am proud, proud to be his mom. He has a genetic diagnosis called STXBP1, and secondary to this, he has a global developmental delay. He does not have epilepsy, though many children with this genetic diagnosis do. And he does have movement disorder, things like ataxia and a fine motor tremor. He is non-speaking, and so he does, he's working on learning to use an AAC device. He does have pica, so loves to eat tissues and paper and crayons. And he is an eloper, so we have special locks on our doors, and he tends to run any chance he gets. Milo is the oldest brother to two younger siblings. He is an avid drummer, drums on every surface available to him, and is pretty good at it. And his name, Milo, actually means humble soldier. And I have to say that this name couldn't be more appropriate for this child. So today I'm here to speak to you and give my perspective as I've been practicing in the emergency department for 10 years now. And I was an ER doctor before I became a mom. And so you can imagine that my perspective now accompanying Milo to an ED as his parent and seeing how very vulnerable he is has really changed my perspective. And I want to share that with you. And in order to do this, we're going to have five learning objectives today. I'll start with the first one. We're going to remember the atypical ways that medical and psychiatric emergencies manifest using the acronym SCREAM. I thought we could all remember SCREAM. The S is going to stand for sleep disturbance and sleep patterns. And this example, we already reviewed a bit talking about Milo, that he had four and five wakeups a night. This was out of the ordinary for him. For him, we were worried this might represent seizure activity. Or perhaps somebody else is coming in with a new onset insomnia, or maybe they're sleeping during the day when that's not usual for them. We're going to consider that this could be an underlying medical or psychiatric emergency until proving otherwise. Our C stands for communication. And so if somebody is able to speak in full sentences or words, and suddenly that regresses, or perhaps they're making new noises or sounds that we've never heard before, or a moaning sound that's indicative that maybe they're in pain, we want to consider that as a red flag. And then rage, we know that our patients with IDD, communication limitations, or autism are more often going to present to a healthcare setting in an agitated state than their neurotypical counterparts. And we want to really be careful to look beyond flailing limbs or violent kind of outbursts to make sure we're not overlooking an underlying medical issue. E stands for enuresis, or really any form of change with bowel or bladder patterns. So if someone is potty trained and now that's regressed and they're having accidents, or perhaps somebody is now playing in their stool or smearing their stool, and that's not something they typically did, this could represent an underlying emergency. A stands for abnormal vital signs, which we're very keen to pay attention to in the emergency department in general. We want to make sure that if the patient is breathing fast, maybe their heart rate is fast, that we're not just attributing this to, oh, well, they're just agitated. We want to really make sure that we're getting to the bottom of why that is, and that we're aware of the patient's baseline vital signs. So it's really helpful if you know what, my daughter's heart rate is usually in the 50s, and today it's in the 80s. That is not normal for her. That's really helpful for us to know in the ER. And then M stands for motor skills. So if a patient's usually able to walk, but now they're just crawling, maybe they're not using one of their arms, we need to be extremely aware of this and presume that there could be an injury or underlying medical issue. So we're going to remember to use this acronym SCREAM while we're seeing unusual presentations in the ED. And now we're going to focus on that rage factor. When patients present with rage, I want us to learn to consider aggression differently, assuming that underlying medical or psychiatric cause until proven otherwise. And when we think about rage, I give examples. There was a 54-year-old male who came from his adult daycare to the ED. He was hitting himself in the face, so had some evidence of new onset self-harm. And his adult daycare staff presumed that he was just copying a peer who did similar behavior during the daycare. But it turned out after a medical workup that the patient actually had a large dental abscess and required an urgent root canal. There's another story of a 12-year-old male who began screaming at the top of his lungs, would run out the front door of his house and scream, waving his hands down the street, hitting himself in the head. He kept doing this for weeks on end, and it took a large medical workup for parents to ultimately discover that he had new onset migraines. And once they figured that out and they were able to give ibuprofen when these episodes would begin, they would be over within 30 minutes and he would be calm and out of that pain. And so when we think about these displays of aggression, I really want to bring this to life with a video. We're going to go look into the home of a patient who does exhibit some extreme behaviors on a daily basis.
This is where he's put his head through the wall, head through the wall. And this is where he stood and kicked it. Ow, 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 ow. He's 6'2" and he weighs 252 pounds. He can go through this house and just wipe everything out probably in 10 minutes.
Okay, so what I want you to imagine is that this young man who displays aggressive behavior on his regular day-to-day, right? There's holes in his walls. He's hitting himself in the head. He comes to the ER when he's having a rough day. He comes to the ER when something is urgently wrong. And so he's going to arrive in the ER flailing. He may be hitting his head through the wall. He may be hitting himself, trying to hit staff. And I can tell you that 9 out of 10 times in the ED, he will be chemically restrained off the bat. So he'll receive IM medications. Usually it's Haldol, Benadryl, Ativan, And then he's going to be sedated, asleep, maybe for a few hours. So when I train our ED staff, I have them watch this video and I describe the scenario that they've sedated this patient. But then 2 hours later, the nurse comes and says, Dr. Deal, this patient's heart rate is now 110. It was 80 before. And we check a temperature and realize the patient's now spiked a fever. Uh-oh. So now we're doing a full medical workup. And we eventually get to doing a CT of the abdomen and pelvis to find that he has an acutely infected gallbladder full of gallstones. And this was his only way of telling us. But we were so quick to sedate him that we couldn't really get a good physical examination, and we delayed the identification of what was going on. And it's a really tough scenario right now, especially as I'm sure you've all seen a lot of the current events. It's not a great day to be the patient exhibiting violence in an emergency department. There's really zero tolerance for violence in EDs around the nation right now. And according to a January 2024 poll of American College of Emergency Physician members, 91% of ER doctors said that they or a colleague were a victim of violence in the past year. I can say the same thing. I have not been a victim, but I have colleagues who've been a victim within the last year and have received, suffered very severe injuries secondary to patient treatment in the ED. And at my hospital and many hospitals, we now are utilizing what's called a patient safety agreement. And what this agreement does is that in the moment that we see any patient in the ER becoming violent, whether they're making a verbal assault at a staff member or swinging an arm at a staff member, they're presented with a patient safety agreement. And they have to sign that they understand the behavior that they must exhibit while in our emergency department. And if they don't, they will be asked to leave the premises. So when I heard this, I was concerned, right? Because as an advocate for somebody with intellectual disability, maybe limited communication, I understand that actually this violent behavior is oftentimes all a patient has in order to communicate what's going on. So for me, I've joined our workplace violence committee. We have a committee for this so that I can be a voice to ensure that our staff members are continuing to look a bit beyond and have different considerations for our patients who have that limited communication or intellectual disability. So one practical way that we've tried to improve or are working to improve at our hospital how we respond when there's a quote unquote violent patient is we have code greens, and code greens are called overhead so the entire hospital can hear when there's a patient who's a acute harm to themselves or self or others. Security will come running and help to either physically or chemically restrain that patient. So now what we're pushing for is to announce a code green sunflower overhead because sunflower is the international symbol for hidden disability. And so we're adopting this at our hospital so that anybody who arrives in the room for an agitated patient who might have an underlying disability, they're going to know before getting there. And they're going to know to have alternative considerations for these patients and to have extra layers of patience and creativity so that we can still know that we are able to be a safety net as an ER to provide care for all patients, even when they're not able to behave within the limitations that we're providing. So, as we're considering the setting that we're working in within an ED, how can we be a proactive advocate, whether you're the person sending a patient to the emergency department, or maybe you're the person accompanying a patient to the emergency department? What do I want to know as the ER doctor? What could help me out so that I can take best care of your patient or your loved one? So we know that autistic patients are high-risk patients, and I'm specifically noting autistic patients here as I'm referencing a study that was done looking at ED visits from 2011 to 2016, specifically in adult patients with autism, ages 22 to 64. And this study showed that when patients with autism come to an ER, they were 3 times more likely to be admitted to the hospital. And then if they were discharged from the ER, they were 3 times more likely to die, to suffer mortality after discharge. And then their ED visits had an almost 2.5 times higher cost associated with their visits compared to their neurotypical counterparts. I share this because I want to encourage anybody who's sending a patient to the ER or accompanying a patient to the ER that you can make a big difference in their outcome by advocating and providing certain information. And I want you to think about the view from the ER doctor. The ER doctor is actually remarkably used to handling and treating patients who are unable to speak to them and unable to follow any directions. So if I show you these three patients, can you tell me which patient is here with a stroke, which patient is here with a drug overdose, and which patient is here with a urinary tract infection and underlying intellectual disability? It's really impossible to tell just by looking, but ER providers are absolutely trained to walk into a room and have no information about a patient and do our very best to ascertain their medical needs. Patients are not coming in with labels. We rarely get time to actually review their chart before starting their treatment. And this is where it becomes all the more important for us to develop ways to protect our patients with disabilities at the outset of care. The other things that aren't working in our favor in the ED, as we know, is time. And this is in two directions: the wait time that the patients are experiencing, whether it's in the waiting room or between different steps in their care, is cited to be the worst trigger for an autistic patient when they visit an ED. That wait time is the worst thing for them. And then on the other side of that, you have the ED staff who are always in a rush, right? We don't have enough time. We're trying to bounce from room to room and take care of each patient. I know on my son's IEP, there's a 10-second wait time built in. Anytime somebody asks him a question or gives him a directive, they're required to wait 10 seconds. I can just imagine advising my ER nurses and techs to wait 10 seconds between everything they're doing or every question they're asking to their patients. You can imagine the culture shift that this would take. Face masks are not helping us. Certainly, yes, they are helping us from an infection protection standpoint. But when we take away the ability for our patients with limited communication to see people's mouths move and see facial cues, it is limiting. Thirdly, screening or lack thereof. So I want you to think about when you fill out paperwork to see your own primary care provider. On that paperwork, if you look at it, it's unlikely that you see an area that asks specifically, do you have a disability? Do you require any specific accommodations? We do not ask this in general at triage or in registration in emergency departments. We are usually finding out on the back end and responding in a retroactive manner rather than being proactive. I find this astounding because as a parent, when I'm traveling or going different places with my special needs child, I am able to indicate whether I'm flying on an airplane or going to Disney World. I can indicate prior to us arriving that we need special accommodations. Why is this not true for healthcare spaces? And then finally, shifting spaces and spaces within the ED. We know that there are so many areas within a hospital and so many people that are involved on the team. And to keep everybody on the same page is nearly impossible. So say I've done a great job figuring out the needs of my patient who's there in front of me with IDD and is nonverbal. And I've discovered that this patient really despises to be touched. This patient wants the lights off and wants minimal noise. But then somebody from the environmental services team comes in and starts emptying the trash, making a loud banging sound, and they didn't know all of those things about my patient. So herein lies the challenge of how to coordinate all the different players we're working with. And the way you can advocate within this setting is to use the acronym BUSY, because we're busy in the ER. And the B stands for baseline. I want to know the patient's baseline. What is their baseline best way of communicating? And how can I understand how they usually interact with others? Are they usually ambulatory? What is their normal presentation so that I can know when they differ from that? U stands for urgency. What created urgency today? Why today are we in the ER? And let's think back to that acronym SCREAM. Did they start making a new unusual sound? Has the patient stopped moving a certain part of their body? What alerted you to something being wrong acutely? The S stands for sensory profile. It is going to be so valuable for us to know in the ER whether this patient is a low sensory or high sensory integrator. And so are they going to be seeking touch and sound and interaction through their time here? Or are they going to be avoiding those things? And we want to know as soon as possible so that we aren't sitting there overwhelming them when we could be controlling what we're doing. And then Y is yield. When should we yield? So if this patient has a known history of absolute aversion and agitation in response to certain healthcare interventions, whether it's getting an X-ray, having an IV placed, having a Foley catheter placed, we want to know because we're going to be considering those difficult moments as we're making decisions about which tests are really worth getting. If I need to sedate somebody to undergo a CT scan, do we really need that CT scan? Is it going to change an outcome? So use that acronym BUSY. And if you can advocate as a support person in person, that is the best, right? Because then you're playing defense, or really you're playing offense. So anybody who comes in the room, you're keeping them accountable. You're reminding them of the patient's needs. And you're really able to be a bridge to connect between the patient and the healthcare providers. Secondly, if you can't come in person, maybe you're a provider sending a patient to the ED or you're a caretaker, call and speak to the ED physician directly. Give a 2-minute review of that acronym BUSY, give that information. And if you can't call or you can't come in person, the third option is to provide in written form that pertinent information that I shared through the acronym BUSY. We frequently get a cover sheet for each patient who comes in, especially from a nursing home or skilled or assisted living facility, but that cover sheet rarely actually provides that helpful detailed information that I need to know about the patient's sensory profile. I see somebody says they can't hear me. Is everyone able to hear? I'm going to keep going until...
I can hear you.
Next, we're... Okay, thank you. So next we're gonna talk about if we do have the patient who's showing up in the ED, how do we master alternative measures to calm our patient? And we're gonna start this before a patient is even agitated by creating a supportive space. And this should be present the second somebody walks in to an emergency department waiting room. I want them to see maybe a nonverbal PECS board. I want them to see a sensory waiting space. I want them to be offered noise canceling headphones. If these things are introduced to the patient from the front end, can you imagine how welcoming this will be? Next, we're going to connect with effective communication. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is to speak to a caregiver. Pick up the phone, call a caregiver, call a parent to find out how this patient communicates best. Do we need to have certain communication adjuncts, such as an AAC device, storyboards, or different indicators to help them through a visual schedule of what's about to happen in the ED? Now, when we communicate with these patients, we want to make sure we're making eye contact with the patient, whether or not they are able to communicate back to us, that we're looking at them, we're assuming competency, I'm going to assume they can understand me, and I'm going to speak using short phrases and directives without offering analogies or large explanations. Next, we're going to encourage positive actions. And a story I love to tell about this is a way that I was able to use behavioral incentives and rewards to help a patient one day. He was in his mid-20s and was having suicidal ideation and had been on a psychiatric hold already in our ED for about 15 hours. So his care was signed over to me at shift change. And I wasn't told that he has autism. I was just told he's here with SI on a psych hold. And the nurse comes up to me 2 hours into my shift and says, "This patient's about to bang his head into the wall. You need to medicate him." I saw on his chart that he has a diagnosis of ASD, so I went to see him, and I saw him facing the wall, and he was stimming. He was rocking back and forth, and he said, "I'm gonna hit my head, I'm gonna hit my head," and I said, "We're waiting for your ambulance. They'll be here in 2 hours. There's a TV. Will you watch the TV?" So I went and I grabbed a piece of candy because our secretary always keeps candy in her bowl in the ER. It saves all of us. And I brought him back a piece of candy and I just said, first, turn your body to face the TV, then candy, you can have this. And he did. He turned, we adjusted his body, we got a show on that he likes, and he was very happy with his candy. I think it was a Laffy Taffy, and that was it. I did not need to medicate the patient, and he lasted through till transport came. And then, if we do have to prioritize safety, and there is evidence that somebody's going to be in acute, is being an acute harm to themselves or others, then sometimes we need to use restraint and seclusion. But when we're doing this, I want to make sure we're doing it only after we've tried all these other interventions and that our security team is aware of these special accommodations that should be made for the patient before us. And that when we're using medications, we are using them in the appropriate manner and we're using the right ones. So, to review, to master alternative measures to calm the agitated patient with ASD and/or IDD in the ER, we're going to create a supportive space from the outset. We're going to connect with effective communication. We're going to encourage positive actions with rewards, and we'll prioritize safety using restraint as a last resort. Finally, we want to avoid use of medications that can cause paradoxical disinhibition. So we know that risperidone pediatrics for agitation in this community. And so it's very important that we know the baseline meds that our patients are on. So if the patient does have an updated medication list, we want to have that if they're coming to the ER. And we want to make sure we're continuing those during their ED care. We want to consider that if a patient has been on a medication for agitation in the past, but they're not currently taking it, that it could be a good idea to restart this medication if they're going to have a prolonged hospital stay. If we do need to give a medication for acute agitation or a procedure, my go-to is ketamine with a benzodiazepine. And when we give the ketamine and the benzodiazepine together, we're both going to be decreasing the emergence reaction that can occur, that confusion or vomiting that can occur after getting ketamine alone. And then when we avoid giving a benzodiazepine alone, we're minimizing that paradoxical reaction that can occur if we give a benzodiazepine by itself. So specific to the autism community, if we give Benadryl, hydralazine, or a benzo like Ativan, Xanax, Valium all by themselves, it actually can cause worsened agitation when our intent is to improve that agitation. So the way I've kind of streamed like this at my hospital is that I've created order sets for medications for agitation specific to the pediatric and adult autistic patients. So the providers can just search these order sets and click on the appropriate meds and doses already laid out for them. And what I want to finally get to is just how do we take everything I'm saying from the classroom to the bedside, especially in a fast-paced scenario like the ER. It makes me think of how I walked on to the rowing team in college. And to first learn to row, I had to learn to use the erg. And I don't know if you've ever sat on an erg or watched somebody else at the gym who really didn't know how to use one. It's a very complex movement. So it took me months to figure out that movement. And then next, I had to take that and get in a boat and learn to hold oars and feather the oars. And so it took a lot of time and patience to figure out how to safely row. Then I had to learn to do this with precision and in an eight, where I'm trying to follow the movements to the millisecond of the rower in front and behind me. And so I had to move with the team. And then eventually it was off to the races when I had my first regatta. And I'm having to do all of these things, but do them as fast as possible. So this reminds me a lot of the ER. How do we take these patients with complex medical needs? Limited communication, who need accommodations, but we're dealing with a very fast paced setting. And the way we're doing this at my hospital is we're rolling out something called Adaptive Medicine Pilot Program, where we're specifically targeting patients who have autism, whether pediatric or adult. And it's an educational program involving two of our emergency departments at two hospitals and two of the inpatient floors. Our interventions are that we're going to do a better job identifying the patients when they walk through the door.
We're going to educate staff on how to communicate, how to use behavioral incentives, adjust the environment, and then properly restrain and seclude only when needed. And then we're going to have prepare by having appropriate equipment that we currently lack. And finally, I've got an awesome bioinformatics team who will be helping us reflect. They've already gathered baseline data on this population so we can show outcomes. We're working on making adaptive medicine resource carts to have in all locations, including things like fidgets, chewies, lap pads, noise-canceling headphones, and communication adjuncts, so that these will be available to emergency department and inpatient patients. We're going to improve patient identification using that sunflower at the check-in so patients have opportunities to self-disclose if they have a disability, and then they'll also be overtly asked whether they have a disability or need for accommodation at the outset of their care. We're going to work to make welcoming spaces within our waiting rooms by facilities modifications. So taking things like this rundown unused closet attached to our waiting room and making it a more welcoming sensory space with noise canceling wall panels and things that could help our patients. We hope to see that we're going to see decrease in workplace violence, improve patient safety and patient experience, as well as employee satisfaction. So finally, autistic children do become autistic adults, and I want to make sure that the emergency department is really a safe space where we can be the safety net for all patients. Thank you so much for listening.
Okay, this one's for Gabby.
Thank you so much. That talk had so much wisdom in it. I really... want to emphasize getting that baseline, thinking about there's a medical cause until proven otherwise, and that using restraint should, there's a lot of things to try before we use restraint, and using the chemical restraint over physical restraint, and using the right drugs, the benzodiazepine with the ketamine has the effect you mentioned, but it also has impacts memory. So if you just give someone ketamine, then it'll paralyze them, but they'll remember the whole event, and it may be very traumatic to be paralyzed while you're having a procedure done or something. If you get the benzodiazepine with it, you won't remember it, and it'll be much less traumatic later. One wonderful, wonderful talk. Thank you so much. We have a bunch of questions. One is, how do you determine who gets the sunflower alert?
So this is all being worked out. I've got an adaptive medicine committee, and we are going to, for the purposes of the pilot program, have a sunflower emblem at registration in both ERs, that will specifically note, you know, we care about your disability or your need for accommodations. Please take, a sticker, a sunflower sticker, and hand it to registration or put it on, just somehow let us know you're self-disclosing you need something, so that the patient can choose without even talking to anybody, just by seeing the visual cue. And then in addition, we'll have registration or triage nurse specifically ask of every patient that comes in, do you have a disability or need a special accommodation? And that will then trigger them to be a sunflower patient. But for the purposes of the pilot, we're starting only with autism or related cognitive disorders. So we will include intellectual disability for the pilot, but for patients with maybe visual impairment or a physical impairment, those won't necessarily be included in this pilot, though we are excited to be more inclusive as we go.
Well, thank you so much for your presentation. And as I was listening to this, I'm wondering, this is probably not standard for all emergency departments. And I'm wondering if associations, whether it's the ED associations or pediatric emergency medicine or, you know, other groups that are supporting this so that it's not in one ED, but in many EDs, and whether there are, I guess, sort of strong recommendations somewhere to do this?
Yes, this is very grassroots initiative happening just within my community hospital, and I would love to see it be more commonplace. But what this is absolutely not commonplace at all, especially within a community hospital. And I will say we are in that season where we're having to creatively roll out the effort and show that it's working in order to then gain traction. And so that's the phase we're in now. And we're working to get funding through grants and philanthropy to move forward. And I hope to see this build and grow and disseminate more formally across EDs in the nation. But right now, this is really a individualized effort happening.
So responding to acronym, we need to be very busy in the
yes. But it also shows that, you know, one passionate person can really make a difference in changing a whole organization. And I've seen that over and over, that you you have the right leader and it can really pull people along. So thank you for that. Is this kind of presentation being a part of emergency medical curricula? It's very helpful. I spent a lot of time trying to educate the ED team on case by case basis, but how can we get this into medical curricula?
The answer is no, it is not. I was not trained in any of this. I was actually shocked at the gap between what I knew of this topic as a resident and young physician, and I've learned so much just as a mom. And so I've got lots of large visions for this. I hope to see this become maybe even like a fellowship option off of emergency medicine. And I know even in the UK, there's an option as a nurse to be go through training to specifically be a nurse along the developmental disabilities path. So I would hope that eventually we could possibly even have a programs at different hospitals where nurses can do their externships, so that each ED has nurses that are specifically trained in people with various disabilities. You know, I'll be speaking in a couple months at the American Academy of Emergency Medicine on this topic. And over the next year or two, the plan is to really solidify a certificate program for adaptive medicine that the healthcare providers at my hospital will earn by going through this education. And I hope to see that spread to training programs and other hospitals. Because right now, I think a big urgency is that I'm going to the ER every day on shift and seeing the acute need to train the providers who are actively at the bedside, and they need help. And so that's kind of where I'm starting.
Wonderful.
So there's some specific questions about medication use. And I think one says hydralazine or hydroxyzine. And then the other, could you please speak a little bit more on disinhibition? And did the slide say Benadryl contributes to it?
Yes, sorry, I kind of hauled through that slide, and it's hydroxyzine, not hydralazine. I'm sorry if I said it wrong or had it written wrong. And so it's essentially that any benzodiazepine, Ativan, Xanax, Valium, Midazolam, if given alone, can cause a basically worsening of agitation. This is also true for nitrous oxide as a sedative that, you know, is used at the dental offices sometimes. And then Benadryl and hydroxyzine, both alone, are known to cause a paradoxical disinhibition. It's similar to why these medications are not recommended in our elderly population, because they're actually, you know, we intend to use them to sedate or calm patients, but then they actually cause a worsening of these symptoms. One quick story, I had a patient on the inpatient side, 34-year-old nonverbal autistic female, who had been inpatient for 5 days, and they wanted to keep her, her medical team wanted to keep her calm, had put her on standing Ativan BID. She ended up having a horrible just self-harm event for 20 minutes, was biting herself, banging her head against the bed rails and contorting her body, and staff could not help her. So I was called upon to help, but I just, the medication, the med recs of patients when they're sitting in the hospital need to be reviewed and kind of held accountable, especially for this population, so.
And I think in the pediatric world, sometimes we're asked to talk about using Benadryl for airplane flights for children. And we always have to sort of say, if you do use Benadryl, please be careful that, you know, some children will not become, you know, sleepy, but something else will happen, which you might not want in a busy airplane.
And could last for an unknown amount of time.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times people have experience with those medications and that doesn't get put in their medication intolerance lists or on their paperwork that they bring with them to the hospital. And so we keep making the same mistake when someone doesn't do well with a medication, that information isn't transmitted as well as it could be. There's a lot of interest in how do we introduce this to our hospitals, specifically UCSF, and you know, a lot of interest in how do we recruit you to build this at UCSF.
Honestly, this program came without planning. It came to me because we started having just patient cases involving patients specifically with autism or who were non-speaking or had developmental disability who were having violent events and outbursts. And I responded, as you know, naturally to those cases. And as I listened to the way we were being advised to handle these patients, I thought, well, that's not how we should be doing it. And so I would say start with patient cases. Find patient cases at your hospital that display the gaps in care and the issues. And I just was loud. I went straight to the top, right? So I went to the hospital leadership, our corporate leadership. And when I did that, I brought ADA into the discussion. You know, we are legally required to be providing an equitable healthcare experience for these patients. Where's our audiovisual cart? Where's our AAC device? Sensory considerations are included in effective communication for this population. So where's our noise canceling headphones? And I didn't have to say too much. They were listening and they're excited. I can't tell you the amount of quick momentum that can be built if you just start that conversation.
Excellent. I'm wondering if you have any experience with cranial electrostimulation therapy, which can be given before procedures to selectively stimulate the parasympathetics and reduce anxiety. You know, some people are using that before procedures to calm people down.
I do not have experience. I've only absorbed some info through reading, but I think that's definitely an interesting thought. I think my approach in the ED, however, just because I have that perspective from the both sides, like to get the ER providers to buy into something, I am trying to keep it so simple and use like what we have right now at our fingertips, even things like how you're moving your body, how you're speaking, even, you know, so that's where I'm starting with training the staff, because we have so much even without equipment at our fingertips to interact with this population and do a better job. And I want to execute these programs and the education to the staff as perfectly as I can, because the last thing I want to do is create a more cumbersome demand for this patient population that's already dreaded and difficult for a lot of providers. And so I want higher technology involved, but I'm also trying to keep it simple to start.
And I'm wondering if you have any messages for, let's say, the primary care physicians or caregivers, both in terms of advocacy and also in sort of making the system work more smoothly.
Yes. It would be my dream if primary care physicians could incorporate into patients, new patient screening, that existence of disability, the need for accommodations, and have that needs assessment established and have almost an emergency room care plan to create that cover sheet with the patient that has that information listed in busy and provide that to the caregivers or parents to say, these are the two pages. It's their updated medication list and it's their busy information. If you go to an ER or an urgent care, take this with you. That's a great place to start.
Wow, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Because a lot of what helps, people are very individual, and it may be, it's not like if they're autistic, they'll want or need the same thing.
Right.
And so having that individual information about what calms or what sets them off can be so important, and it can be something very unusual. I had somebody who was afraid of cotton balls or, you know, it can be something very, very unique to them, or having their socks off and
right.
had a big battle getting into an x-ray machine, which they could have taken the x-ray through the socks just fine if they had known that. Just understanding that individual and being willing to ask them and ask their caregivers is so important. There's something showing up in the Q&A here as a last question. I had asked a question yesterday regarding informed consent requirements for psychiatric meds and medical medications for psychiatric reasons. Can you talk a little bit about that, about informed consent in this environment?
I didn't get to hear the question yesterday, but the question is whether we need to obtain informed consent in the emergency department before giving any psychotropic medications?
I mean, if you're trying to deal with these emergencies and you're giving medications how do you handle the informed consent?
If there's emergent consent implied, essentially. So if we're in a scenario where there is acute harm to the patient or a staff member, we are protected under having that emergent consent that we can go ahead and restrain a patient or administer medications. For all other medications outside of that, if we're trying to give a PO medication or a patient's home medication, we're working pretty carefully to discuss with their either the patient first and then their care provider or POA. We're very used to in the ED getting in touch with patients' power of attorney, making sure they show that paperwork to support the DPOA. So if the patient is unable to agree to take a certain medication, we can speak with their representative. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for stepping up today. And thank you so much for your education. This is fantastic.
Yeah. And just one more thought is adding on that paper in terms of that last question is stating clearly if there is a DPOA, if there is guardianship in place, or if the patient is an autonomous decision maker is such important information. I should have added that somehow into the busy acronym. And then I don't think I provided my contact email, but I'm happy to be a resource for people or continue conversations later.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.